Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Your body is unique, so why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Jenny Slate. For at least a decade, Jenny Slate has been one of my favorite stand-up comedians. It started when she co-hosted Big Terrific with Max Silvestri, past guest, and Gabe Liedman, future guest, I hope. It was a weekly comedy show in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and it was the best, or at least my favorite, for years. Back when there was live comedy still, it eventually morphed into a monthly show at the Largo in Los Angeles. And Jenny was just so hilarious and specific and free and open on stage, it was indescribable. The issue was, for many years, describing her comedy was the only option, because Jenny refused to record or film her stand-up. Eventually, Jenny became known for other things. There was her one season on SNL, which she sometimes credits for the start of her terrible, awful stage fright, which she still has never really gotten over. There was Marcel the Shell, the impossibly charming stop-motion viral video in which Jenny provided the voice for a sweet little shell with shoes on. But mostly, she's known for acting, be it in her breakout role in the 2014 indie hit Obvious Child, to comedy guest spots on shows like Parks and Rec and Kroll Show, to her voice work on shows like Bob's Burgers and Big Mouth. For context for this interview, 2016 and the years that followed were sort of a grand reorienting for Jenny. This was largely due to the election of Donald Trump, her divorce, and the explosion of the Me Too movement. Creatively, the result was twofold. First, she wrote Little Weirds, a hard-to-describe book-shaped thing that's part memoir, part short story, part feminist spiritual text, part collection of magical impressionistic pieces of writing filled with gentle, sensitive creatures, which Jenny credits for saving her life. The other, partly inspired by the release of Hannah Gatsby's Nanette and the frustration Jenny felt by the men who questioned if that special was stand-up, Jenny rededicated herself to live comedy, eventually building to her actually filming and releasing her first hour special, Stage Fright, on Netflix. The special, which also mixes in documentary footage of Jenny with her family, was directed by Gillian Rosebier, Jenny's collaborator on Obvious Child and 2017's Landline. And the goal was not to make something perfect, filled with bulletproof material, but to try to actually capture the vulnerability and spontaneity of what Jenny does on stage. All of that is on display in the short section we're about to play, which comes towards the top of the set. If I can say one thing, pay attention to Jenny's energy as the joke progresses. So, here is Jenny Slate.
This is a performance. but what has happened, unfortunately, is that since Y2K, I've just been melting... I've been melting my brain by pot. I know, like, a brain is supposed to be like... like that, like, have, like, mass and volume. My brain is more like a crepe that has been rolled by someone who isn't French and is not committed to the cuisine. And then... And then inside of the crepe is just one, like, naked wiggling worm that's, like, getting really tired and, like, doesn't know how it ended up there in, like, that bad sleeping bag. And it's just like, oh, mother. And then I imagine my brain like the bathhouse and Spirited Away, like like it's like a thought comes in or like something to discuss, and it's like a token that pops down in front of the worm's face, and the worm's like, modern art? Oh shit, man. And then in life I'm like, Jackson Pollock put jizz on his paintings. Jackson Pollock, starring Ed Harris, put jizz on the painting. And then someone's like, get out of the Guggenheim! And I'm like, Guggenheim? I thought this was the aquarium. You guys fucked yourself by calling them your museum the Guggenheim. That museum is fun because you're like, whoa! I went there one time on drugs.
And I'm here with the person behind the joke you just heard, Jenny Slate. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the joke itself, let's talk about weed.
Okay.
You started smoking, I believe, senior year of high school, but it was in college you really took to it. On Seth Meyers, you said it was like finding your soulmate. Fast forward, it seemed by at least 2015, you're starting to have less of a positive relationship with it based on certain tweets I was able to find. One was, doubt I'll follow my own advice when this anxiety dies, but I think it's time for me to stop smoking weed. Jenny, please stop. Please remember this, SOS. And I do believe you quit sometime later. So those are just sort of the facts that gives people a sense of the timeline. But
sure,
so much as it was a relationship, can you talk about how it evolved from when you started until when you decided to stop?
Yeah, sure. I was not in any way really like a partier in high school. I think I didn't really have access to those situations until the very end. And I also was kind of afraid. And then my senior year of high school, I did smoke weed on the eve of Y2K on that New Year's Eve. And I remember smoking weed for the first time. And I was like at the top of a hill in New Hampshire, and like, when I was done taking my first long hit of a joint, I was somehow at the bottom of the hill surrounded by cows. And I was like, I guess this is what the future is. Like Y2K came in and it's just me and cows. And I'm like into that. And in general, and I really had never felt the sensations before of like just being super stoned. And I really liked it. I liked how it made music sound to me, and like all of the things that are really cool, I guess, about responsibly using marijuana. And I continued that relationship for, decades. Whereas like it was really, really fun in college, and getting stoned never had any sort of like undertones of paranoia. Mm-hmm. Once I got further into my adulthood and maybe had more to lose or learned more about myself, or just saw the world more clearly, I started to get really paranoid. And then eventually I really had to stop, because I don't know if you smoke weed, and you don't have to say, but like there used to be for like years, like 7 years at least, a moment when I would smoke the weed and I would just flip out. I would just completely silently flip out, and my heart would beat so fast, and I would be totally enrobed in this just like, oh my God, I cannot believe that you think that what you're doing is good, because it's bad. And everybody can see that your personality is bad and your decisions are crazy. And you've made so many of them, and everyone saw it. And then I started to talk about it a little bit on stage, but then I truly took in too much THC one evening and like melted my dome for good. And I've never been able to turn back. It's over.
When was that thorough melting?
That was in the fall of 2018. And what happened was that I hurt my back, and I was just trying to take some CBD gummies, And my friend Jane was like, oh, okay, well, I have these gummies. They helped me when my stomach hurt, and like, they'll just help you relax your back. So here you go. And there was like a dropper of a THC activator. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, I don't really, you know, smoke a lot of weed, so I just took one dropper, but you probably have like an, you know, infinite tolerance, which is true. Like, I used to smoke weed a lot, like a lot. And I just didn't think anything about it. And so she was like, I don't know, you should probably take two or three droppers. So I was like, okay. I ate the gummies. I took three droppers. I ordered Thai food and I was like, well, this will be the best night of my life. You know, like, I'm just truly about to chill. And then the next thing I knew, I was like sitting at my dining room table. And oh, and I decided to watch the movie Amelie because I thought that would be delightful from what I remembered. And I was like eating the food. And all of a sudden I was watching the movie and I was like, what language is this in? Like, what language is the movie Amelie, what are they speaking in? And like, when did this movie get so scary? Like, why is it so reminiscent of like a Polanski, The Tenant or Compulsion or like one of those movies where someone just goes crazy alone? Like, what is this? And then I was like, I can't breathe. And then I realized my mouth was like stuffed with noodles and I was not even chewing. And I was like, oh my God, it's poison. It's poison. Poison. Someone poisoned me. And I wiped all the food off the table and ran up the stairs in my house like a dum-dum in a horror movie. Like I'm going up the stairs. Made it to the top of the stairs, barfed on the floor, and then was like, ah. Oh. I guess I got to get into bed, you know, and I got into my bed with all my clothes on, got into the bed by entering it through the bottom of the bed.
Of course.
And crawling on my stomach up like under the comforter and then sort of like rolling myself over in bed and was like, I need to call for help. I need to call for help. And then I was like, no, it's too late in the evening. Everyone's sleeping. It's like they're slumbering now. You're lost. You're done. You're going to die this evening. You're dead. And I looked at my phone and it was 6:45 p.m. And I was just like, I just was pretty sure I was going to die. And I was like, I have to pee. How would I ever do that? Like, I don't, every time I go to the bathroom, I'm usually in the bathroom and like my pants are on and how do I get those off? And I couldn't make any connections. And then apparently I sent a lot of texts to different friends about like what's going on in patriarchy. And then I left myself a 2-minute and 26-second long voice memo. And it was like the meanest thing. I listened to it like 3 weeks later because I was like, ugh, what's that going to be? And it was like the meanest thing I've ever heard. Like it starts with a laugh. That is not my laugh. I mean, it really, really bummed me out. But it was like the laugh instead of my normal laugh was like, and then I say to myself, why do you have to cut everything with a spiral blade? This total vague abuse. And then the next day, my friend Jane texted me and was like, hey, got all your texts last night. I feel really bad, but I meant to say two drops, not two or three droppers. And so I think I took about at least 120 times the dose of THC. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I have not been able to smoke weed ever again. And I really don't miss it. It really messed me up. The end.
The end. Now to talk about your stand-up. In general, how does your comedy work, sort of the process of deciding to talk about something on stage and sort of refining how you say it? How has that style evolved? I just ask because, like, as a person who's been watching you for a while, what I know is there's sort of you are freewheeling upstage. I remember I had a friend who saw you at, I think, a festival, and you did two headlining sets, and you did completely different hours both times and didn't even realize you did different hours both times. So how does it happen? You know, how do these ideas get in your head? How much organization is it? How do you sort of, like, become more particular with how you put the things you put?
Well, I think the first challenge as a comedian is that you do bits. And there's something about that that can feel really inauthentic. You know, it can feel like lying. But that's not how I'm sure a lot of people will put it. But that just has to do with my own organization inside my mind as a person. And I think the way I do it is I know enough to understand what things are entertaining and what things are funny. And mm-hmm. that's a social skill that I learned as like a person who is like doubtful and like shy, even though it might not seem that way. Underneath everything is a feeling that's like, maybe this just like every time I'm about to go anywhere, there's always a moment before I go in where I just try to go home. Mm-hmm. And that is it's like the seed of every interaction. So what I choose comes from a social feeling of trying to please people and trying to, become a part of something. But I think it happened for me after I left SNL that I really just wanted to be able to ignore, systems and rules when it came to comedy. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff you can't ignore. Like you have to give something that people want to listen to and you can't just like be self-indulgent, but I think it's just a social instinct. And then before I go on set, on stage, I make a set that's just bullet points. So I'm not just like fucking off in any way. In fact, I find a flow. I put the bullet points down. And if the things are too written, I feel embarrassed and I'm bad at saying them. But if I don't exactly have all the transitions written out, but I know my stories just the way that you know yours. And mm-hmm. if you're like, you know, at a dinner party or on a date and some of your best stories come up, that's how it comes up for me. And I do have lines that I repeat for sure. And I do have bits that go together. But there's just a lot of material there. And I guess, I don't know, like I saw on my Twitter feed, I try not to look at that much at like the, you know, replies to me or the ats that are from strangers, because I think that offers, either like poison or treats. There's not like a lot of in between, but someone was like, yeah, I loved her special, super loose, but I still liked it. And I was like, oh, what do you mean super loose? Like, why is that bad?
Yeah.
You know, like I'm just a human being on a stage, like doing talking basically. And I think there is always the ability for me to do different hours because I just care about the relationship in the moment and not very much about the perfection of the bit. Yeah.
In so much as like anyone who has stories, the more they tell it, they sort of quote unquote better they get at telling it, or the more they understand how people receive it. Are you paying attention? I guess the question is like, are you noting what works in a way that, let's say, a more rigid comedian who's really trying to pound it out would be like, I'm saying it this way, I'm going to remember it, so then I can know if I should change or not. Do you even try to pay attention to how you say it? Or is it more instinctual of like, you say it one way, and every time you say it, and then over time, just like, it flows into sort of the way it becomes?
I think it's the second. I think that it flows into the way that it becomes. I think that's exactly right. And that if I try to repeat something word for word, I usually take the life out of it. But I do notice things. But mostly it's like social. It's like I notice when things don't please people. Mm-hmm. Like I used to do a joke that was sort of, I would never do it now, but it's just where I was in my mid-20s. That was kind of it was like a joke making fun of how I look. I guess it was about my nose maybe. And I just remember being like, people don't like it when I say this. They don't want to do this with me. They don't want to abuse me with myself. This is something that I do alone and that actually I shouldn't do on stage and that I should kind of try to not do in general, even like internally. But a lot of times, the reason why I do record my sets now is that, just like in this conversation, like I say the things that I mean, but I don't often remember them. Mm-hmm. And when I decided to just take the step into feeling some sort of legitimacy about my comedy, which meant like stop seeing it as just a social thing that you do, and actually realize that just like all of the people that you're around, you are a professional and you can like, you can take some space with this if you want. You can take some time and you're not going to ruin it if you record your sets. And so I did start recording them, and usually like about 4 hours before a show, I'll listen to a set that I remember as like really fun. And, and I'll put those bullet points down again. And I probably won't say the thing the exact same way, but I get close.
So with this joke, at what point does it become part of your act, and sort of what was the initial spark that you're like, you're going to talk about on stage, in as much as you could sort of remember that this was something that you remember talking about in a public, I guess, forum?
You know, this joke, I really don't remember when I started to do it, but I do know that the Guggenheim part of it was said for the first time when I recorded my special. So,
oh, wow.
I probably have made fun of the Guggenheim before because I'm a shithead. And, you know, but I mean, I just, the dress rehearsal for the special had gone so terribly, was genuinely the worst show of my life. And so I just wanted to try to be myself and do some new stuff in the special. And so what was there, though, was like, I was thinking about my brain in terms of like Miyazaki imagery for a while. And I think I had mentioned that on stage a few times, but I really couldn't tell you. It certainly was just, I don't know, like pretty recent, like a couple months maybe, and just a few times.
So it's interesting because it's not like you had the beginning part of this joke with the worm and the Spirited Away, and then you had a different example. You were just sort of like following this thing, and then maybe being in New York, you're like, oh, the Guggenheim. And then that is sort of like typified whatever this mindset it is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if it's that tight. Like, I wish I could say, yeah, New York.
So was this even on your outline to do this thing generally about how your brain was melted by weed and then you just sort of followed it along? Like, what?
Yeah.
But you had no idea how it was going to end. You're just going to be like, I want to talk about this. I have the sort of Spirited Away imagery somewhere in there, and then we'll figure it out.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and there's not even a discussion like that. Like, for me and Gillian Robespierre, who directed my special, you know, I ended up in her movies because she saw me on stage. And she, before I became a professional actress, the first thing I ever like really acted in that someone paid me was like when I made, I think, the short film of Obvious Child. Or maybe they didn't pay me. But either way, that was like the first time, you know. So she knows what I'm like, and she wanted to record me as I am. I used to have this joke that was always often at the start of a set. And it was about how, well, it was kind of a disclaimer. And I think I do that because I do anticipate people being like, this isn't stand-up, is it? You know, and like, I really don't like that. And I reject that. But I also know that you can't, even before you give somebody something, tell them that they're not going to like it, because that's just a bummer. And so it used to be like, I've been smoking weed since Y2K, and the joke used to be about like, do you guys remember Y2K? It was when all the dads freaked out and thought that, you know, the computers were going to make it be 0 o'clock outside.
Yeah.
And that used to be a pretty formed joke. And it was very formed because it was like a diving board. And then it would be like, so anyway, I've been smoking weed since Y2K. So I'm melted now. And whatever I can possibly muster tonight is like what remains. So you know, if you're here to see something more than that, I would suggest either closing your eyes or turning around or, and leaving or like whatever. Yeah. And so that's kind of where we were. But I think there was a discussion about, are people going to know who the guy is in Spirited Away who takes the tokens? And my feeling was kind of like, I don't care. You know, like how many times has there been like a sports joke that I just like don't know who they're talking about, but I still enjoy it because I like the way the comedian moves and talks. Like they can like that. And also they should discover Miyazaki.
Do you remember if you said the full version of the Y2K joke on the night and you ultimately edited it out? Or when you say the joke in the special, you just say Y2K and it gets a laugh, you know, as if you have told the full joke? Is it like, oh, they laugh at Y2K, I can just sort of move on? You're like, oh, the audience is telling me they already kind of get where I'm coming from.
I don't remember. I think there was a reason why I stopped telling that joke. And I just don't remember.
That's
because I melted my brain from weed.
Sure, yeah.
But what I do think was that there were two jokes that used to be kind of tent poles. Or like one was a door and one was a pole, let's say. Mm-hmm. So the Y2K joke was a door or a diving board. It was an entry point. And then in the middle of my set, there used to be a joke about people who say that they're weird. And mm-hmm. that like people who say that they're weird are not weird. Like they clearly know that it's become attractive to say that they're weird. And their examples of being weird are always like, I'm just like weird. Like I like to eat like breakfast for dinner and like eclectic things. Like none of my pillows on my couch even match each other. It's like interesting. I'm like weird. And that a true weirdo like goes into Starbucks and asks to see a menu. And like sure. or a true weirdo is like, you know, the only way I can come is when I look directly at the sun and that's how I doink it or whatever. And you're just like, no. That's not how you come, or I guess, I mean, you can, but I yeah. ended up taking out that joke, I tried to do it, and it just was, it was funny on stage, and it wasn't funny when we watched yeah. it. Like, it was like, this is crazy. I don't know why. And then we were also like, well, okay, Jenny, but you just said that a weirdo masturbates like this, but then at the end of your thing, you masturbate by looking at the moon. So like, what's your message? And I was like, well, I don't know. So we took it out. But I think there was, I don't think that I started that joke and did not complete it. I think what probably happened was that I was like, I'm bored of this.
Yeah.
I'm so scared because the dress rehearsal is so bad. And I know that boredom is the thing that makes me bad. So I know this is like my most developed joke in a way, this Y2K dads thing.
Yeah.
But I guess I have to throw it overboard.
You yeah. know? It's probably symbolic to yourself to be like, this is the thing that I have most prepared.
Yeah.
So I'm going to throw it out because that's the thing that's getting in the way for me to do actually what I need to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I remember it. And like, there is nothing better to me than a new joke that just sounds so much like how I think and that people would laugh at that. And I love metaphors. I think they're so funny. And I just like love those comparisons. And in the moment, it was just like, you know, I haven't worked towards this point in terms of honing my material. I've only been crafting a way to communicate with people in this like special way. Mm-hmm. And I think what was really bumming me out before we were going to film the actual shows was like, I've been doing this thing in good faith for so long. I've been putting myself out there. It's really real. I really, really believe in it. And I'm messing myself up because there's like a dolly cam here, yeah. you know, because I'm in an outfit that we already picked out or whatever, like these weird things that made me feel a little bit like harnessed. And so Gillian did her best to like chill me out, and I do think it worked in yeah. the end.
I want to ask you about specific parts of the joke, less about, you know, how you formed it or whatever, more just like what you like about it now thinking back on it, and what does it evoke to you? So you describe your brain is more like a crepe that has been rolled by someone who isn't French and is not committed to the cuisine. What do you like about that image? It reminds me of how you open your book with your fantasy that someone would see you, see past the woman and sense that you're actually a homemade Parisian croissant. What is it about these sort of French food image that you're like, this communicates what I want to do in this moment?
Wow. I've never made that connection before, but I think, you know what, I think of French food as really fancy and sort of snooty and like really, really indulgent and buttery. And I really enjoy eating. I enjoy eating it. But I guess what I like about that joke is just that I don't think it, I just think it's exactly how I think. I think you could give it to somebody else to say. It's enough there that it's not just all personality, you know, like it's not just all gusto, but that I said that in the moment, it was not written, and that I said to someone committed to the cuisine, the reason why I like it, other than that I think it's just really funny to word it that way, committed to the cuisine, you know, like a person, and that you know that that's true, that a person at like, you know, like Jake's Crêperie in the Denver airport is not like, I love French cuisine, sure. You know, and that there's truth there, but that like, I don't know, it's just such a serious way of saying something so stupid. And I think that's why I like that whole joke. I am really proud of the way that I observe life. I like how I do it, and I like experiencing it. And I also just feel so tender towards the fact that it is so juvenile, but that it's not lazy. It's like, I'm giving you a full picture, whether or not the picture is of a fart machine. You know, that's like, if you don't like that, then I completely understand that. The work is enthusiastic and it's complete, but it's like the work of someone doing a perfect somersault without pants on. You know, it's exactly. Just like stupid.
The next part, you introduce the naked wiggling worm that's getting really tired and doesn't know how it ended up there in that bad sleeping bag. Can you tell me more about this worm? Like, it felt like, though you only described this worm's place of existence, that there was a larger picture of what this evokes, this worm. I don't know what I was about to say, he or she, but in my head, there's a specific worm. Can you tell me more what this worm you thought of?
I mean, I guess when I think of a worm, I'm usually thinking of the worm from Looney Tunes that, like, I'm pretty sure it wears glasses, but... You know, I like the idea of the psyche being compartmentalized and that, like, inside each thing is a little sweetheart who is trying really hard but failing and set to a task that they're not, like, born to do. And I just love that a worm is so meek and that it has, like, truly no way of like, reaching out for anything and is just, like, there to... It's like there to do nothing, you know. It's just such a bad situation. It doesn't have arms or legs, and it's stuck. And I guess I just love it because it's, when I think of it, I think of it as both meek and like hyper stressed out. And I don't know. I don't know if I'm answering this question right.
No that's exactly what I imagine. It's more. If you asked me if I thought you made it up all that night or if you'd been doing it for 10 years, I wouldn't be able to answer it. But the main thing, especially with the imagery, it felt like you had a very specific image and you're able to have it be so specific because your picture of it was very full. And though you describe it sort of succinctly, you do have a full picture of it. And it's the part of the special that feels most like your book, Little Weirds, in that, like, that it's filled with the book's filled with these sort of small animals and creatures, and it's why the Spirited Away bathhouse image makes sense, because it's all these sort of, like, different creatures all working together, and they all have the little sections.
Yeah.
And it, so my question was, you know, to, for me, it's like when I'm in therapy or whatever, I'm trying to describe a feeling that is sort of out of reach of my own personal vocabulary or experience. My brain finds like a moment in pop culture or scenes or characters or a joke. And I sort of use that vocabulary to express something that I might not have before. For you, when you are trying to express these things, do these creatures just appear? You know, like you're just like going down and then like there is this image. Like, is it a visual thing in that way where you are, it's like you're just like walking down and like here's the creature and there, it's almost like your brain, it pops into it. Or is it a little bit more deliberate of like, oh, I have this feeling, what represents that?
Yeah, it's pretty fluid. It's like the image just pops in. And then I think that is paired with preference. Like I was just thinking like, why did I do a worm? You know, because I know I just like put that together in that moment. But like, you know, you could say a worm or you could say like a coughing shrimp, you know, that's like getting really dry and actually like is like not cold anymore the way that they're supposed to be when you eat them at a party. Like it doesn't mm-hmm. have snap to itself anymore. But like that to me is too sad. Yeah. And like a coughing shrimp is a little bit too like dark and a little bit too like evocative of like I partied too hard or I've been smoking, you know, mm. I've like been smoking cigarettes on during my shift or something. And it's the worm. I do think that I almost always go towards things that are working and either succeeding or failing, but like in earnest. And yeah. that, like, I don't often like things that are, it's just not what I like, that things that are, like, rock and roll or, like, that are dark, you know? Like, it's very, very rare that you'll see tougher images like that. Even, yeah, or, like, yeah. in the special, there's, like, a joke about a little boy who is a ghost and asks, if he's missed the picnic and that then he throws up. But even then, I just think of him as like a little boy with, you know, dysentery or consumption. Like he's just existing honestly as a ghost.
So the next part is to speak to sort of your example of how it's someone doing a perfect somersault but with no pants on. The next part, which is the Jackson Pollock part, but it's the fact that he put jizz on his paintings. I guess first question is, do you remember learning that fact?
And yeah.
Being like, this is a fact that's going to stay with me forever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I learned that. Is that a fact? I mean, I just know that, like, I remember someone said that and that, like, it pairs with, like, feelings that I have about a lot of male artists from the 20th century that I'm just like, I guess. But I've had that fact in there forever. I have also never seen the movie Pollock.
It is interesting when you put it that way. This joke is like sneakily feminist, as if it's like you're telling the Guggenheim like this is what you call art. The fact just because he jizzed yeah. on a painting means it's art.
Yeah. Oh, it's always that. I mean, it's and at this point, it's not like not on purpose or on purpose. It's just something that happened for me that like once I had whatever you want to call it, some sort of awakening to the realities of true patriarchy and what it means to have internalized misogyny, which is something that like I and I think everyone deals with, even if externally you're like, I don't like misogyny. There's, you know, we're born into patriarchy and it's just in there. Misogyny's in there. And so it's like now I'm just always sort of gesturing at like where I think it is and showing that it's ridiculous or dressing mm-hmm. it down. And I think there's also just, it's like why people love Dumb and Dumber. You know, it just feels so good to be like, oh my goodness, you guys are so fucking serious, aren't you? You're just so serious with your big museum. It's a ramp, you know, and I like to go there. It's not that I don't like to go there, but I also just, I don't know, the snobbery, and it's so cool that it's there, but it's not untouchable. In fact, yeah. like the fact that it's a place where you can't touch anything just makes me want to like touch it with how I talk.
Yeah. This part has a really impressive stretch where you're essentially doing four different characters and voices at the same time. You're doing the worm, your present-age self, the self at the Guggenheim who's like stoned, and the Guggenheim security guard. And it's also the point where I was watching it to see, because it's early on, it's like, you seem a little bit more nervous at the beginning, and then by the end of this joke, you like barely can tell the joke. You're laughing so much.
Yeah.
Is it a moment where you're like, I think I can do this, where this feels comfortable? This is more of a diving board or a door for yourself than imposed to the audience of like, oh, this is fun. This is the sort of thing that I wanted to capture.
I think it's an unconscious realization that I can do something that I'm scared to do. And like, it's always funny to me when people are like, oh, yeah, I mean, I love that at the beginning of your special, you're like, you're nervous. And I'm like, you can see that? I mean, for me, that's just how I start every set, you know? Or I just want that to be without a qualification. Like, that nervousness is bad. That nervousness is not the sign of a professional. Mm-hmm. Because it is the sign of my professional process beginning. And if I weren't nervous, that would be bad. I'm not trying to stay nervous. I don't like it. But this is just what it is. But like, I will say, I could feel like, oh my God, you know, this just works. And it just, I think you're seeing somebody who is really starting to experience like a infusion of power and pleasure. And the only thing that I'll say is like, I don't think in its like finished form that I've watched the special all the way mm-hmm. through, because it just makes me feel nervous. Because I'm like, how could I ever do this again? How did I ever do this? But that like, get out of the Guggenheim, that impression to me feels lazy.
Oh, interesting.
And then it is what it is. It's what I had then. But like, it feels halfway to Adam Sandler. I'm like, this is a little dorky. Not that Adam Sandler is dorky. I'm not trying to like say that, but I don't think that. But anyway, I'm just like, that's lazy. You know, I wish I had picked something else. And I do kind of like how it's just a plain impression of a security guard, because also it's boring.
Yeah.
Which is right.
He was not going to say a funnier thing. Like, he wouldn't sound like a comedian who has a perfect thing to say.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what voice would be good for that. Anyway, but I like, clearly I'm still not good at my own joke, but the whole point is to get to the other side of being expelled. So that I can do the thing that I love the most, which is to laugh in the face of the person who tells me what to do and say, like, you have no fucking idea how much I don't give a shit about this. That's what makes me laugh even now in my own kitchen. I'm just like, you legit don't understand, like, how much you fucked yourself.
The joke that comes after, which I love, I mean, like, it's one of my favorite moments of the special, which is you guys fucked yourself by calling your museum the goo 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 goo.
Yeah.
Which is a nice moment, because it's also like, it's being like, I'm not crazy or weird about this. I'm rational. The world is weird. It like, it fits into like a what a lot, especially the beginning part of the special, which is like, let me explain how my brain works and why it's like not bad. It's like totally normal. Let's like ingratiate. Did it feel that way for you, or you're like, where it's empowering in a way to be like, I'm right, world. That's a dumb name for a museum.
Yeah. I think that is exactly how it feels. It just feels like, well, you know, if you wanted people to come here and know what the museum is, you should have made it look like a like something else and called it a name that's easy. But it's obviously also a useless and immature retort to someone who can make me leave a museum.
Sure.
But it just really does shine a light on the silliness of how it's a bit snooty. Mm-hmm. And again, like, you know, the 80s, like, movies in the 80s are so into making fun of people who are snooty. You know, just like the whole Abe Froman Sausage King moment in Ferris yeah. Bueller, where it's just like, we don't show the like super white affluent in that same way anymore. Like mm-hmm. That just like stuck up, you know, in Mystic Pizza, it's kind of the same thing where Julia Roberts' boyfriend goes to the country club. And I just grew up, thinking that snootiness was really funny. And yeah. by the time you grow up, especially if it's like, you're like me, you lived in Brooklyn, you're a comedian, you do think art is cool or whatever. Yeah. You forget that actually the funniest thing is to be like Tom Hanks in Big at a party and eat a one of those like tiny little corns like it's yeah. corn on the cob. Like that, to me, that kind of innocence and petulance and powerlessness is so funny and yeah. and worth a disruption.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been watching you perform stand-up for years, like 13 years. But I don't know where I first heard this, but I just sort of knew you didn't want to film your stand-up. I knew people had offered, but you just sort of didn't want to do it. So much so in the summer of 2016, I even had a coworker ask you about it in an interview. And you really had so many reasons why. It's a really good answer, so I will read your answer.
Oh, good. Said,
no way you remember. If you remember, that'd be wild. You said in the interview that appeared on Vulture, maybe I only want to live in the moment. I want to be able to create it again and again using the same stories, but tailoring them specifically to the people who are there and what the vibe in the room is. It feels like asking why did or didn't you record your birth or your wedding? Even though in my case, there are other people there, I feel like my stand-up is personal experience. I want to be like a wild animal that runs through your backyard free, a flash of movement, something other. I like the flaws. I like the oddness. I don't want to say this is what I am and what I did. I just want to keep getting up there no matter how hard it is and say I'm here in the way, in this way, in this outfit, in this mood, only now. You know, besides, as you said, Netflix let you completely do the special on your terms.
Yeah.
You know, what inspired you? What happened in the sort of 3 or so years after that quote? And then how did you believe you can achieve the same thing you talked about in that quote, but in a film special?
I think that what first happened for me was that I started to spend a lot more time alone. Mm-hmm. For like the first time in my adulthood, I was not in an intense, serious relationship. And I always felt like my best stuff kind of goes to my partner. Mm-hmm. And then I'm on stage and that's great, but there's no reason to like work extra hard to make my stage thing more. And then once I started spending time alone and starting to write, I was like, I just started to see, and it's going to be hard for me to connect the dots and be articulate about it, I think, but that I had put a lot of my energy into my partnerships and I just didn't want to take the extra time to put it into my work. I wanted mm-hmm. my greatest work to be my romantic relationships. And I saw those failing over and over again because of limits in myself that I don't think I could get past, or choices that I were making that really didn't make sense for who I was. And when I was alone, I was just like, oh, I want to get into my work. You know, I'm realizing I'm not taking it to the end. I'm doing the equivalent of partying, you know, like even though I'm not drunk on stage for the most part. Like there have been times when I legitimately have like pulled a cigarette out of my hair and started smoking it and been like, who did this? But that's not where I was at. And, what changed was that I just experienced a moment where I was like, wow, I really like writing. And I want to write a book. And I actually have been through a really formative personal experience in like my mid-30s. And I want to write about it. And I just want more. I just wanted more. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to give my energy to someone else anymore because I realized something in me was really dying. And I had been on the verge of like kind of tapering off of stand up and doing more films. And then I guess around the time that like, I guess in the fall of 2018, I want to say, and I had like a couple, I had a movie come out that summer and like a, like kind of a large movie come out that fall, the movie Venom. Mm-hmm. And I just felt really lost. I really did not understand the decisions I was making in my career. And I looked back at some of my old notebooks, like from my days in Brooklyn. And I was like, these jokes, they're not jokes. They're, you know, they're bullet points. But I was like, what is this lobster tank? Like, what does that mean? What was I doing? And I just thought, I've been working at something for so long and I'm acting like it's not legitimate. Mm-hmm. And I just have to step up. And so I wanted to do that. And that to me felt like a personally feminist move in that I was like, I have been giving my power away, for the sake of like harmony in a home that I have continued to lose. Mm-hmm. And I have harmony in my own home when I'm here by myself. Let me get real about what I want. I want this. And I don't want anyone to fuck with me while I'm doing it. Like, I don't want it to change. And so I asked Gillian Robespierre and Elizabeth Holm, who I worked with on Obvious Child and Landline, like, will you do this with me? Will you protect me on it? And I asked my agent if she would ask if I could do a Netflix special. And I was like, I don't want to have to write a statement to anyone. Like, I've been doing this for long enough that either they'll let me or they won't. But I can't tell them what it's like going to be about really. But, <Yeah. laughs> but if they would like, but I wrote a letter that was kind of like, I want to be able to explain myself on stage. And I think of it as sort of a feminist symphony, rather than a battle cry, because I've fought my own personal battles and now I'm like, I'm just ready to use those sounds and celebrate. I'm here. And, you know, I'm sure my life will tank again, but like, I'm here. And the way that I did it so that it was not disturbed is that like, I just used the people who knew me the most. And, we had an all female crew also, which was a really great vibe. And I just kept myself really protected rather than being like, what star move can I do or something? Like, I don't even know what that would be, but there was never anyone in my mind to do it except for Gil.
We'll be right back with more Jenny Slate.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain, and their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
And we're back with Jenny Slate. So in the intro of Little Weirds, you describe what it's like for you to perform. And I just love it. I was hoping you would read that section for me.
Yes. Okay. When I am on stage, it is mostly my party, but I am hoping to throw it for us, to honor our having the faith to come together and feel something bubbly and balmy as a collective. I am throwing the party for the sake of itself, for yourself, and for myself. On the stage, I am thrilled and moved, but before being seen by you, I have been terrified, often ill-tempered. I have most likely ruined an entire day by fretting about this evening. Just before I open my mouth on the stage, with bright faith in everything, me, you, that the building won't fall down, that I will catch on to the thing that helps me zoom, that a man won't come in and shoot me, etc., I have most likely used my same mouth and voice to tell everyone backstage. I know I say this every time, but I feel really off today. I can tell that it's going to be bad. Once I'm up there, so many feelings happen at once. The lights are shining right into my face, so I can't really see you. I imagine you as one complex but benevolent identity. I am nervous but also excited for you to see my onstage outfit, chosen just for you and the people. It took many tries to choose this one outfit. I was trying to figure out what I want to be wearing when we all fall in love. On stage and everywhere else, I know that there is so much you could do to me. My vulnerability is natural and permissible and beautiful to me, and it should remind you of your responsibility to behave like a friend to me and the world.
When I read that part in particular the first time, you know, I loved it. But all I can think about is how different it is from how many stand-ups usually talk about their relationship to audiences, historically, but even fairly recently, which can be so antagonistic. Like, I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to kill. You know, how do you feel about that? How did you feel having, you came up around people that probably talk that way? And, you know, what does it mean to sort of so... I guess brazen. I don't know if the brazen right word. To so run counter to the culture in which stand up has sort of defined what should be exchanged.
You know, yeah, I know that language, and I'm sure I've said to friends, "Oh my God, you killed it." But I guess I said you killed it. I'm never like, "Yes, yeah. You knocked him dead," whatever. But I think what I've been lucky to hold on to, and I really can't say why, except for that, you know, in a world that way overuses the word authentic, and it's actually just become kind of disgusting. I think that there is something in me that just does not want to be other and doesn't mm-hmm. want to lie. And that, so as I've started to have a career and you know, when I started on SNL, that's also when I got a Twitter account and stuff and started to also put my personality out there. What I did, just I think out of instinct, was to be the same person everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's affected by culture. But there is a choice to make if you focus on how you specifically speak about who and what you're interacting with. And I think those choices are incredibly important. I think they're really, really important to me. Talking about stand-up the same way I talk about romantic love makes sense to me because those are two giant loves and I'm the same person mm-hmm. in either situation, yeah. You know? And so, I don't know, it's not that hard. It's just who I am. And also it's what I want. Like, I want love from stand-up. I love stand-up, but I also want, when I get off stage, to feel that the people felt loved and that I was loved by them. And that sometimes can be really gross to admit. Like, I want love, because mm-hmm. sometimes it sort of smacks of some sort of internal injury. But also, everybody has an internal injury, and it's not bad. And I just want to be able to speak about things differently, which is also why I decided to write my book. Mm-hmm. And it's also why I get up on stage and instead of being like, what's the metaphor for when your brain's ruined by drugs? I don't know, like Swiss cheese or something.
Yeah.
Like there's a way to say the same thing to people and they might just laugh if you say, I did too much weed and now I can't remember stuff. Like people will just laugh at that. Like you don't have to do so much, you know, but this is what I have to do and I just have to do it.
It reminds me of, you know, after the news of Louis C.K., all that stuff came out, I wrote a piece about how he, along with other sort of comedians, represented this idea of honesty in a way that made them feel better, in a way that's like confession, which is like, I'm going to tell you everything about it, and then you're going to say I'm not bad anymore. But sort of like leaving the audience with nothing. And really, and it reminds me a little bit also, you talked about how sort of stand-up has misogynist rhythms, how there is a belief that you should do it one way.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this sort of lines up where it feels like you are pushing back at the basic idea of like there's whatever the one way is, which has been defined by these certain men this entire time, just by being like, I'm just not going to do that way. I'm going to do it myself. Is, I mean, it becomes radical because it's been so hard to sort of break that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think I remember reading that and I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, the most dangerous thing about what Woody Allen or Louis C.K. are doing is that they're bringing this thing out into the light and acting like since they've mentioned it, of course it won't really occur that they're going to cross these lines. You know, it's such a sickening maneuver. And I feel that way about it completely. I just think it's wow, it blows me away. It blows me away. And in a way, wow, it must really suck to have to do that. And that sounds condescending, but I mean it from a place of like, I have not been able to function with the level of rage I feel sometimes, about the like Me Too situation in general and many other situations, but that, there's a way to also be like, I am so glad that I have figured out how to masturbate at home. You know, like it's not that hard. I haven't talked about it in stand-up because I did see a couple of other women talk about it. And I was like, I don't think I have anything better to say than that. But like where my rage kind of comes from is just seeing a system exposed. Mm-hmm. And then weirdly clutching to my own sexuality and being like, hi, do you think I'm not the horniest fucking person that ever lived? You don't think I've been like rubbing my body against stuff since the second I found out that I had a body? Like I've figured it out. I have figured it out. So have a lot of people. And it just feels bad. It just feels really bad. So there has to be a way to be like, whew, thank God I didn't do that. Thank God I didn't do that. Anyway, I got off topic. as it can be, but honesty, you know, I was just talking to Max Silvestri, who I know you've had on your show. And we were talking about a character that we're creating and, that I will hopefully play. And what her deal is that she traffics in intimacy. And that's the phrase that we were using. And there's a way to traffic in intimacy and honesty and, it's something that I have kept my eye on because it's not that I don't have things I don't want to talk about. I do. I have things I don't want to talk about. But there are some things that are in the zone of I could be ashamed of this. I could hide it. Like my new stand-up that I'm thinking of now, which is a good example, I think, of this, is that what I really don't like about myself, one thing is that I can be really like threatened and jealous by my partner's former partners. Mm-hmm. And I just don't like that about myself. I'm embarrassed of it. But when I start to talk about it out loud, I notice that it's starting to make me laugh really hard. I was telling my friend the other day that like, yes, it's normal to run into exes, like my partner's totally cool when we run into people I've been with, but like every time we see someone that he has been with, I feel like the second that person looks at them, that the second that person looks at my partner, that they're just saying with their eyes, remember when I came? that's how hard it is for me, is that I'm like, I'm pretty sure that this woman is like, remember when we were like at that place and I like came, you know? It's just like, it's torture. I hate it. I don't like it about myself. I do think I do the right things at this point in my life to not try to like ruin, you know, like it does just ruin my partner's day with it. But anyway, there are things to share and work through, but like to use honesty in a manipulative way is that's a dark choice. Yeah. That's a dark choice.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about in stage fright and in the special that, you know, before you go on stage, you know, you're funny, but you're just sort of afraid they won't like you. What has it meant to have this special come out and have it sort of be firm proof that people like you as a stand-up that you could point to and be like, well, there is film proof that you sort of can't deny that there is people that respond to it. You know, what has the response done as you sort of like think about yourself as a comedian or an artist moving forward?
I don't know. You know, it's hard. It's like when we finished the special, I think we all felt like this is what we wanted it to be. Like, thank goodness. Just like, thank goodness it did happen. And I was really pleased, really warmed up and like, relieved, I guess, by the fact that it was like critically well received. Mm-hmm. And also like sort of, I was saying this to my friend the other day, like when things occur in nature and you know they occur, but they're always like, oh my God, I can't believe it happened. Like just when you put a plant somewhere and it does move its whole plant body to be near the light and its whole body represents that, that inclination, you know, it just like is off on some weird direction. You're like, yeah, everybody says that plants need light and they find it. But like when you see a plant do it, it just can almost make you cry. And that's kind of how I felt about the special coming out, was that I was like, I was exactly my organic self, including a massive failure in the dress rehearsal, which like, I know I keep mentioning it, but I do think about it a lot, that it was incredibly scary and bad. And I was really embarrassed. And I remember that two women who were in my high school class, who I don't like know very well, but wanted to reconnect with, they were nice enough to come. And I was like, oh my God, like, wow, way to double up on that nightmare. Like you just ate it in front of them now. Like, but yeah. but so that was really nice. But then it just kind of, I don't know, you can't hold on to that.
Yeah.
Like what's next? In fact, I've only just done a tiny little part in a movie since then. I went on tour for my book and I don't know, I just kind of let it bloom and fade because you really, after a while, like you hold the thing in your arms, but it does become lifeless, like that praise. So that's how it feels. And then I don't know what it is about me, but there's always a part of me that's like, yeah, it was good. Like that was legit good. That was legitimately good material. And I liked how I did it. But does it get the same attention that like these other comedians who are women are getting? I don't know. Like I kind of always feel a bit niche, even though I don't really think that I am. I really don't think I'm niche. Like I think I'm as like edible as, you know, buffalo chicken tenders. Like I think I'm really serving that, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I don't get it.
Considering it's a time where essentially no one has been able to perform comedy in front of a live audience because of the pandemic, have you had time to reflect upon your relationship to your stand-up or stand-up in general?
Yeah, it kind of feels like when someone dies, and you're like, oh my gosh, if they were here, all I would do is just listen to their stories that I've heard a million times and like, or just tell them how much I love them, you know, and not let a moment pass where my eye isn't just trained on them. And that's how I feel about stand-up, that I'm like, wow, I've acted like this was a given. And that maybe one day I will be inappropriate for the art form. You know, like maybe I'll just become like just kind of corny and it won't be good anymore. That's a possibility, but it's made me just be like, wow, I can't wait until, you know, in LA, the place where I perform is most often is Largo, that theater Largo at the mm-hmm. Coronet. And that's where my family is and, my comedy family. And I just want to get back there. And I also haven't changed at all in that I'm like, ugh, what if I don't have anything to say? You know, like there's all this time has passed. What if I don't have anything? But I do, even if I get up there and I'm like, well, I've been sitting in silence for, you know, a year and a half. So it's nice to hear the sound of my own voice, JK. I constantly talk to myself or anyone who will listen. I've been actually spending the last year and a half listening to my voice. You know, like, whatever. That's an example. Yeah. But something will come. But, yeah, I really miss it. And I'm also scared of it in the way that it's, you know, when they say it's just like riding a bike.
Yeah.
Like, there's also that part where you're like, yeah, but I don't remember how to ride the bike. That's what I'm saying. I remember what it's like to get skinned knees. That's what I remember. Like the only thing I have right now are my legs and I can see how they might be ripped open.
I mean, I will say as a person who's been following your career, who has been a big fan of you for a really long time, that is the most, like you've sounded like I'm a stand-up comedian and I can't wait to do the thing that I do. I feel like there were times where you're like, oh, I do stand-up, but I'm trying to be an actress and that is... the stand-up facilitates and it's like a way to hang out with my friends. But this is like, I feel like the listeners don't know that does feel like a radical departure, maybe a bit of being like, oh, I can't wait to, when I think of what my normal life is and what I am, it is doing stand-up.
Yeah. I mean, I love making movies and I hope that people will still let me be in their movies when people make movies again. But, the power that I felt when I made my special and the realness, the self-actualization that I felt was really important to me. And, you know, as I grow more into my adulthood, I'm 89. I just turned 89 and my legs fell off and so did my head, but I'm still here. But as I get more into it, it's like, I just see how my own ego works mm-hmm. and how I can become, I could just get so trounced by my own ego. And I think stand-up has just become more and more dear to me. And it's also really local. It's like, I don't really like the idea right now of having to leave my partner and be on a movie set without him. But I love the idea of going to Largo where Max Silvestri is and Gabe Liedman and my best friends and that, you know, Ben, my fiance, is like watching from the side of the stage while I say like how my jealousy issue is insane or whatever. And I mean, and still when I say that out loud, I'm like, I should not have mentioned that. But it's not like... it's not like there's harmony in my life, but you know, I don't know if you've ever felt this way, but sometimes you arrive at a truly like bountiful, beautiful, serene time in your life and you still find yourself being scared of stuff that you realize doesn't apply anymore. It just doesn't apply. Like it doesn't, there is nothing that my partner does to make me feel scared of his connection to me. And so now I'm like, oh, this thing's so weird. It's like I have a weird spike coming out of the front of my head. And I'm just going to talk and talk until it falls off.
I do feel like that is partly the sort of like Jewish experience, the sort of like our generation of like there's the children of the children of Holocaust survivors of like nothing can be fully good. So don't allow, like, it's just sort of not allowed. It doesn't compute. I think sort of our brains are like, well, there has to be something wrong. I will create it if I sort of have to.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a bit of that. I do tend to think of myself as a, I've described it as like being a relentless optimist, but I think that what I have been profoundly affected by is the ways that straight white men have been able to live and have sex in patriarchy, and the way that everyone else has had a different experience. And of course, those experiences really range. And that entire thing also is connected to like racism, you know, like it's a whole fucking mess. But I think for me, what affects me the most is not a general, I mean, I am a very Jewy person, but like, not a general feeling of like, the shoe's gonna drop, I might as well throw it on the floor or whatever.
Yeah.
But that it's like, man, you know, I know guys get really offended by this, but there's just been a lot of disgusting stuff forever. And most of the parents have not told their, or at least, you know, like I'm speaking about like white males, like most of them have not been cautioned to, you know, watch how much they eat out there. and it's just scary. It's like, I do think there's a joke in my special about it. That's like, do you get it? Do you get it? You know, or do you not?
Yeah.
And, yeah, a lot of people find that offensive and scary and like, it's an overgeneralization. I'm lucky that I have a partner who doesn't feel that way. But there's nothing scarier than a male partner when you're like, you need to look at like a lot of stuff. And even if you say it nicer than that, you know, I don't think anybody loves that way of being addressed, including me. I would not want to be addressed that way. But if, you know, you try tenderly to reveal some of the way the operations are going down, and if a partner's like, no, that doesn't exist, and you're like a crazy radical bitch, then it can make you lose faith. And I think I'm arriving at a point in my life where I'm like, oh, okay, I have like a truly dreamy feminist partner, and like, I know how I want to do my work, and I'm starting to realize more and more how I just want to be in this world. And I'm so scared a lot, because I don't see many examples of functionality, but I also only wished or dreamed that I could be how I am. And I have become that, without much resistance from myself. Mm-hmm. So maybe the best things can happen.
You know, talking about this as sort of a time of reflecting, you know, recently you announced on Instagram that you're no longer going to voice the biracial character of Missy on Big Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how you came to the decision, and was there something in particular that opened your thinking, and how does it sort of fit into sort of where you're at?
Well, everything's connected, and I will say, like, I am definitely down to talk about that, but what I don't want is to be like overly congratulated.
Sure.
You know, like I just, I don't deserve, like, I just, it's okay to talk about it because I think it's a good example. I think of somebody being like, oh shit, I really messed up. And I've learned how I've messed up, and I've only really recently understood those specifics, and it's going to take forever to like divest myself of the racism that has been allowed into me because I am a white person born into a culture of white supremacy. But, you know, I think that when the news went from coronavirus to George Floyd's murder, and a very real and persistent, necessary discussion of, now you can't use the word like persistent without just like invoking whoever told, you know, what, you know what I mean? She persisted, or whatever total shitbag said that. But Thank God I can't even remember the name. Like, let's not. But first I was like, okay, well, what am I supposed to do? Because if everybody this, like, the week after George Floyd was murdered, there are all these people who have a lot of followers on Instagram, like, let's say, like, people working in Hollywood or in the media or whatever, and posting pictures of George Floyd or Black Lives Matter. And I was like, I'm not sure what to do, because I don't want to just be doing something for the ornament of it or for the look of it. And I don't want to just be like, yep, I'm a good white person. I posted on my thingy, so you can't say I'm bad. But then I also thought, well, I can't not say anything. And I thought, what is that about silence? What is that about a silence that I almost did just because I had decided, well, I don't want to just be somebody who's like doing a shallow thing. And so I spent that week like getting in touch with a person that I know who took a course on white supremacy and asking for their course packet and like buying myself some texts to read that I was like, someone told me to read this 2 years ago and I should have read it and I'm going to read this. And setting up monthly donations to different organizations to help the Black community. But I still was like, I don't get it. I'm just missing something. And for a while, I had thought, I don't think I should play Missy. But the reasoning that seemed okay to me at the time, which I now realize was not, was that I'm one half of the character.
Yeah.
You know, which is basically the same thing as like being quote unquote colorblind.
Yeah.
And I understood that as racist reasoning. And of course, like a white person, you know, that thinks of themselves as progressive is going to be totally nauseated by the fact that they might have done something racist. But we white people do racist things directly, even though they might have been like unconscious or not on purpose. As Robin DiAngelo says, there's a difference between, you know, what you intended and what your impact was. Mm-hmm. And I think the final straw for me was that I saw a video on one of the writers on Big Mouth. He had posted a video about like how to be an effective activist versus just like an effective ally versus a good ally. Mm-hmm. And asked that people make a list of what three things they could do. And, you know, I just was like, this is really clear. I'm just, you know, we're acting like a biracial actress doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know who will take that part, but like, she does exist and she'll be wonderful. And like, it's just not my part. It's not my thing to take. And I understand if people don't. It's funny that like, you can clearly see that some people don't understand, but it doesn't matter. To me, there was the full support of everyone I work with. And it's hard, obviously, to see that you've missed a lot and to see that you're part of a problem. And I am, and I still am. But what was important to me was to try to word my statement in a way that was clear and not focusing on myself and focusing on the issue. And that was unemotional. And not asking for anything except for just to be able to take a moment of accountability. Mm-hmm. And then you know, the rest is how people feel about it. Is again, like, that's part of the cultural dialogue. But I think the time is really now to get clear on beliefs. So that's that. But it's really, It's so weird because I obviously just did talk about it for quite a while. But yeah, it's like you don't want to make it about anything but the just what needs to happen. Like it's – I forget what the analogy is, but or I think it's in the book White Fragility that – it's like when there's an accident, you don't like go to the person that drove the car and hit the person and comfort them because they got in an accident. You go to the person that got hit by the car and you help them. Yeah. And I think that's like, that's the deal.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite joke, street joke, dad joke?
My favorite joke to do, I guess, is like kind of a prank. And it's like when you drive by a stranger and you roll down your window and you're like, "Hi, Linda." And then the person just looks and they don't know what happened. Is that a joke?
That counts.
also, I love pantsing. Pantsing. Only in the house. Only in the house. Yeah, I wouldn't like do that in the world, obviously.
Is there a joke from another comedian that you wish you could have that like you wish you could steal it? You wish there's another dimension where everything was the same, but you had this joke or at least a part of this joke or something that you got to say or just a joke that you wish, oh, I thought of that.
No, but in general, I just like always wish I could be like Max Silvestri. I think he's the best comedian out there. I think he's the best. I think there isn't anybody like him at all. He's like a total bolt of lightning and he's like completely unique. Yeah. And every time I hear him talk on stage, I'm like, what? I am in deep admiration of what he does.
You have a new movie coming out that's set in Norway. What's a fun fact about Norway?
Oh, I like how they say, thank you. It's nice. That's a nice way to say that in Norway, when you say thank you, you say talk. That's a nice fact, right?
Yeah, it counts. It's nice.
Talk.
In interviews, when people ask you about SNL, they want to talk about just the time you cursed, and you've talked about it 9 million times, and I don't really care. But do you have any other nice memories you'd like to share? Because I feel like you don't get to talk about any other thing about that time.
Oh, yeah. I have lots of nice memories. The main one that sticks out right now is that J-Lo was incredibly nice to me. And, at the end of like a week together, she told me that I was made for this. And I remember just being like, well, no, I just can end my life. I love J-Lo, have loved her for so long.
Let's end with this. Can you, I guess, say goodbye as Marcel. I want to hear Marcel's voice. I feel like I haven't heard in a while. And can you just say goodbye?
Okay. Like, I guess what I'll just say is that I want to say goodbye, but it's only so long. Not goodbye. Like, so long. I'll see you again. That's a song I know. But goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Stage Fright on Netflix. You can buy Little Weirds wherever books are sold. You can watch Jenny's new film, The Sunlit Night, on video on demand starting July 17th. Follow Jenny on social media, at Jenny Slate. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Art Chung, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars. Please, email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with the best specials of the year so far. Have a good one.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work. Yeah.